our podcast this week, we have a double whammy of British Oscar winners as Colin Firth and Rachel Fies pop along to talk about their new film, The Mercy. Plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that just dropped without warning on Netflix this morning. And Netflix were not pleased, let me tell you. They were not happy. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I am joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning and one for the very first time. James Dyer, you all know him. You all know how he earns a living.
I like this. I like being positioned as a kind of Western bounty hunter. This is good.
Yeah, as a madman.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't know Ben Travis.
Hello.
You do now. Hello, Ben. You are our new online staff writer.
Yeah.
Making your pod debut today.
Yeah, it's wicked to be here.
It's wicked to be. See how young he is. See how young he is. He's just used wicked unironically.
Can you imagine if I used the word wicked?
I think you'd be banned in many countries around the world if you used the word wicked.
I think that would be fine.
Okay, so, Ben.
Yes.
You have 30 seconds to tell the Empire podcast listenership about yourself. Wait a second. Let me get the timer up. Okay. 30 seconds. Stopwatch.
Okay.
Go.
So I'm from Nottingham originally. I live in London now. I love Jurassic Park. It's the best film ever made. James upset me this week when I was speaking about that. Elsewhere, I love Star Wars. I've read Empire since I was 11 years old.
You must be tired.
Yeah, I'm knackered. Non-stop flicking through the mag. Mm-hmm. What else do you want to know?
Just your hopes, your dreams, what you want from life. Yeah. Oh, we're out of time. Sorry, Ben. Yeah, 30 seconds.
We
got the basics. It's all good. Welcome to Empire.
Thanks.
How has it been so far?
Yeah, all good. James is giving me scary eyes right now, so I'm working directly with James.
Yeah, don't tell the truth, basically, is what that look
He is,
means.
In many ways, the Anakin Skywalker to my Chancellor Palpatine.
I was going to say, is this Phantom Menace small child, or is this
I think we're probably towards the end of Attack of the Clones starting Revenge of the Sith at this particular point in time. Your journey is
the massacre?
Complete. I should be asking you to kill a room full of children at some point in the near future.
I mean, that fits with everything that's gone on in the last few weeks, so...
Yeah. Order 66.
Execute Order 66. You want this, don't you? Anyway, how's Ben? Forget Ben's in the room. How's he been so far? Has he matched up to expectations? That sort of thing.
Well, only time will tell. But only time. I am turning him to the dark side. He has let go of his good feelings and embraced his hatred and anger.
Okay. And if people want to follow you on the Twitter machine, what can they do? How can they do that?
They can follow me at Ben S. Travis, because somebody already took Ben Travis.
What a motherfucker. Yeah. Who did that? Who took Ben Travis?
I think at the time they didn't even use their feed. I think it's probably like an egg account.
Right, okay.
So now I've got a slightly more unwieldy handle.
Could everyone not follow Ben? Because half the people who listen to the podcast don't follow me. So if they start following you, I'm going to be very upset.
What if they follow
So they can only follow you if they follow me at James C. Dyer first.
Okay, no, that's not going to happen. This is a weird thing. So there's a Ben Travis 1973. There's a Ben Travis CEO. I imagine he's a CEO. There's a Ben Travis music. I imagine he does music. There's a Ben Travis 1990, a 99, a 10, and a 94, and a 21. But there's no Ben Travis. There's no Ben Travis. He's an egg. There's a Ben Travis.
Oh, okay.
He hasn't tweeted. Now, you could do what I did. I'm not sure if Twitter would still do this, but I didn't used to be at Chris Hewitt, and then the at Chris Hewitt account wasn't being used by whoever had it, and I went to Twitter and I said, this person is impersonating me, so kick off their account and give me Chris Hewitt.
Crack the
you
egg.
Absolute
and they did.
Bellend.
Yeah.
That could have been another person called Chris Hewitt. They're not impersonating you. They were just holding their name.
But that's a Twitter policy. That's the only way they would have given you a thing.
I do fondly remember the week and a half where Nick and I were verified on Twitter and you weren't. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but they verify everyone nowadays.
They do nowadays.
Ben, are you verified?
I'm verified.
There you go.
God damn it. Literally anyone.
There you go.
I'll take that back, Ken.
Ridiculous.
Anyway. All right. So welcome, Ben. It has been a pleasure having you. I'm so sorry about everything. And you ready for your first question on the Empire podcast?
Absolutely.
All right, here we go. So this is one that we were embroiled in an argument today on Twitter, Jimbo, by Fats Coleman, at Fats Coleman on Twitter, who CC'd us into a conversation he was having. He ran a poll saying simply, is Aliens a horror film? Now, Aliens is your favourite film of all time.
It is.
It's one of my favourite films of all time. Is Aliens a horror movie? Now, as we were recording this, the poll is 60% no and 40% yes. And we've been going back and forth with some people on Twitter because you and I have both said unequivocally it is not a horror movie.
It's not.
But other people suggest that it is a horror film.
They're wrong.
Why are they wrong?
Now we get into the whole issue of genre bleed, don't we? I mean, it's not. It's an action movie. It's a sci-fi action movie. Specifically, it's a sci-fi platoon movie. It has horrific elements, but it's not a horror film. I mean, yes, if you were to Netflix categorize it in terms of many, many, many sub-genres, you could probably put it has horror aspects in there. Mm-hmm. It also has comedy aspects in there, but it's not a fucking comedy.
Well, it's not, the horror aspects are more prevalent
than comedy
aspects.
Certainly, but they do exist. It's like we kicked this around when we did our list of the best horror movies. Like, what defines a horror film? What is a horror film? And I seem to recall us getting into it with Johnny Pyle, who insisted that Jurassic Park is a horror film. It isn't.
It's not a horror film.
No, but he insisted that it was because it has horror elements in it. But I kind of, in my head, I defined a horror film as something where its primary motivation, its primary goal as a film is to scare you. Like, that is its raison d'etre. I think the BFI, I have a definition here, and it was the BFI's. Horror films are unsettling films designed to frighten and panic, cause dread and alarm, and invoke our hidden worst fears, often in a terrifying, shocking finale, while captivating and entertaining us at the same time. Which is, frankly, quite woolly. But you get the point. It's designed to terrify first and foremost, and Aliens isn't designed to do that. Alien is a horror movie, mm-hmm. without doubt. Mm-hmm. Aliens was never designed as a horror film. That's not what Cameron wanted to do. He wasn't trying to replicate what Ridley Scott did. He was trying to spin out into do something different, which is exactly what he did.
Aliens is more like thrills than outright scares, right? There are scary moments, but it's built into the tension of the action sequences and of the kind of situation that the characters are in, rather than being the kind of like jump scare cat moments and the face hugger moments and stuff from Alien, which are outright horror beats.
Oh, there are jump scares in this.
It has jump scares. It has horror beats. Absolutely. Ripley's dream sequence where she sees the alien emerging from her chest is a really unsettling image. It's very, very hard to shake. There's the moment that always gets me every time I watch it when there's a face hugger in a glass display case.
And it has a massive erection against the glass.
And it thumps against the glass. Yeah. And it always gets me. Oh, he likes you, Burke. You know,
The cocooned colonist when she opens her eyes and the strings do that little
There are definitely horror beats, I will say that, yes, but it is not primarily a horror film.
No.
In the same way that you wouldn't call Captain America the First Avenger has a musical number in it, but it's not a musical. So just because a movie has some elements in it doesn't mean that it is that thing. I would say.
But we kicked around all sorts of stuff when we did this horror list. I mean, because Ghostbusters is kind of a comedy horror, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's not a horror film, but it has very strong horror elements.
Yes, but I would say Ghostbusters is closer to horror than Aliens is,
so
because it is just concerned with the supernatural, it's concerned with evil. It does set out to scare you.
And
it
Gremlins
really does.
Is another one.
Gremlins is another one as well, yeah. And certainly, someone got in touch with me on Twitter and went, a film can be more than one thing. Yes, it can.
It can.
But this is about, is it a horror movie? No. Does it have horror elements and horror beats? Yes. But those horror beats subside as the movie goes on and it becomes an all-out action movie. I would say even the bit towards the end, and spoiler if you haven't seen Aliens, by the way, where the aliens come in through the ceiling, that's tension. That's not horror. Mm-hmm. So I think it stops having horror beats pretty much around the time that the facehuggers sports a massive jubby, to paraphrase James. I'd never thought of it in those terms before, but So are we decided?
Yeah. What would you say The Terminator is? Would you describe that as a horror film?
No.
I think the sci-fi elements are so strong and the time travel element is so integral to the story that, for me, that's like primarily sci-fi.
It's less, I think I don't view it as a horror now. I think I did at the time. I mean, again, it was categorized as a horror in my video store. I remember that quite clearly.
Yeah, another guy got in touch and said, well, tell that to the people who put aliens in the horror section. I want to have a word with those people because they're wrong. But it's interesting because The Terminator has a lot of tropes, obviously, of stalker slash movies.
Exactly.
For example, it's very similar to The Hitcher, which is a film I absolutely love. Mm-hmm. And The Hitcher, I would say, is absolutely 100% yeah. a horror film, yeah. but The Terminator is not. Definitively answered at Fats Coleman. And if you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, and quite frankly, why wouldn't you? You'd be weird if you didn't. You can get in touch with us via a number of methods. We are at Empire Magazine on Twitter. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us as well. And you can email us also, where we are podcast@empireonline.com. Or you can just DM Ben. His DMs are open. Slide into his DMs.
Please don't. Please don't.
I just realised, Ben, I don't follow you on Twitter.
Oh. Is that actually... Really?
Yeah.
Dreadful, man.
Hang on a second.
This is you checking. You're not going to follow me now.
This is going to be the first live follow.
Follow the other Ben Travis first.
Online staff writer at Empire Magazine. My visual acuity is based on movement. If the apocalypse comes, tweet me. Ben, I am your 1,928th follower.
Hey.
Look at that.
Did you know, Chris, I got an announcement from Facebook yesterday to tell me that you were my first ever Facebook friend. That's fucking tragic.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. There was a little picture. It was like it had a little heart around it and everything.
What?
Yeah.
That wasn't meant to be in the public domain.
Bromance. Thing.
Okay. There we go. I'm very honoured. Should we talk about some movie news?
There's some big news.
What's the big news?
I don't know. It might be something Star Wars related. Might be a couple of Star Wars related things. It might be all Star Wars.
All Star Wars.
All Star Wars all the time.
We've had
not one but two trailers for Ron Howard's solo A Star Wars Story.
We mean not one but two.
I mean, look, we had a little Super Bowl spot and then we had a trailer, but I'm saying...
But they have different things in them.
They do have different things in them.
Did they?
Yeah, there's different stuff in the spot.
Yeah.
Wow, I wasn't paying that much attention, to be honest.
So that was quite exciting. I mean, we are 3 months out from release on this film and this is the first, realistically, that we've actually seen from it. So, I mean, we were kind of hoping that this might suddenly, frankly, make us all redundant, but just drop on release day and just give us something genuinely new and surprising. That was never going to happen, but this was interesting.
Yeah, no one's ever going to release a film without warning, without marketing, without trailers, posters, anything like that. That's a pipe dream. Forget about that. That's not going to happen.
Can you imagine if Han Solo had dropped on Netflix on Monday? And we'd have been like, what the hell?
Yeah, it would have been interesting.
There would have been a lot of sickies in the Empire.
I think in time. But yeah, it's like I said last week, it's cutting our nose off the spider face. Because if that happened and it was a huge hit, and then suddenly all studios go, oh, we don't need to do any marketing whatsoever. And then you and I are out of a job. And
Just us sitting in this pod booth talking about stuff we've seen on streaming.
Essentially, which is probably where it's going to end up, let's be honest. But it's certainly an interesting trailer. What do we think of it? I think that the overriding thing is that it looks a bit darker than I was expecting.
Yeah, it's quite muted. Like the tone of the trailer itself and of the visuals and stuff, considering we were all expecting this to be like comedy, right?
I think the tone is misleading. From what I have heard, the comedy is strong in this. And certainly if you've read, there have been some articles recently, some interviews recently, which have implied very much that the tone is very light and it is very comedic. So I think this is a trailer that slightly missells it. I also think it's a remarkably generic trailer and I think it's very bland and there's not a lot that's memorable in it. I still have a lot of hope that this film will be very good. However, you compare and contrast this with the first trailers for The Force Awakens or The Last Jedi or even Rogue One and it's not in the same league.
There's no money shot in the trailer. There's no that one moment that everyone is talking about apart from, I mean, the biggest thing really is the shot of Donald Glover as Lando, which is
the best
amazing
thing. Yeah, he looks
the
fantastic
huge coat and all that stuff.
He impresses in a way that Alden Ehrenreich really doesn't. Because he does a very good impression of someone who is nothing like Harrison Ford.
Well, what he's clearly done, and it's really, really unfair to judge things on based on how many seconds of speaking footage, 15, 20 seconds.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go down that path just yet. Let's wait and see the finished thing. But what he clearly seems to have done is choose not to sound like Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
He's not doing a Harrison Ford impression, and I think that's probably the right thing to do, You're going to have people comparing him to Harrison Ford anyway. If he was doing an impression, it would just... He's leaving himself open for a kicking, to be honest. And so he's trying to forge his own thing.
It's a thankless task to take on a role previously occupied by one of Hollywood's most charismatic actors. I mean, it's a tough act to follow. But he doesn't... It's certainly in that trailer, he doesn't have it, where Donald Glover, in essentially one shot without opening his mouth, really does. So that's unfortunate for him.
Well, we shall see.
Yes. Also in Star Wars news, a new trilogy.
Another one.
A new trilogy, not Rian Johnson's new trilogy, but an altogether different trilogy.
Yes.
Behind that being D.B. Weiss and David Benioff, the Game of Thrones showrunners, which is very, very exciting in a kind of fandom collides thing.
I'm kind of excited and nervous in equal measure because I feel so invested in Game of Thrones that I know the scripts are done and they're like already shooting, but there is a big part of me that just goes, please get the end of Game of Thrones right and then move on. But
keep your eyes on the ball, people.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I think this is really exciting news. Like the prospect of those guys who they get a bit of flack these days. The response to this on some of our social channels was pretty mixed overall. People
it was.
Aren't as like overwhelmingly positive on Game of Thrones as they once were, and I think partly like the recent
really?
Seasons where Benioff and Weiss have kind of had to forge on without the kind of firm base of the books. They know where the plot's going, but they're the ones kind of telling that story rather than adapting that story.
The internet in negativity shocker.
We
talked about this in
that.
The office yesterday. Yeah. I mean, people give Benioff and Weiss shit for the fact that they think Game of Thrones has kind of gone down in quality, and I think that's wildly unfair. I think it has, it's certainly sped up. I think the tone has certainly changed. But also, like, people don't even, they're not even referring to the most recent season. They're just saying that the latter seasons aren't as good as the early seasons. But frankly, the same criticism can be leveled at the book. The first three of Martin's books are vastly superior. It peaks with A Storm of Swords. And A Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons are not as good. So it shouldn't be a shock that the relevant episodes associated with them aren't as good either. I don't think they've done a bad job at all in sort of forging ahead into the undiscovered country, as it were. No, I think they're great. I'm very excited that they're doing this. I think they've shown an ability to collaborate with world builders in the past. I think they're phenomenal storytellers. And their eye for detail and mythology is great. So, I mean, I'm fascinated to see what they create as a kind of counterpoint to what Rian Johnson does with his trilogy. And while, there is the concern that we are going to, at some point, get to saturation point and it's going to become, like, really more Star Wars, I'm nowhere near that point, and this has invigorated me. I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how, Solo does from that standpoint. But this is another new trilogy, so we've got two new trilogies. Mm-hmm. I do wonder whether the Skywalker saga is going to wrap up with Episode 9, whether they're going to forge ahead into uncharted territory.
They're going to have to leave it for at least 10 years or so, right, before they go back and do, if there is another Skywalker trilogy, that's going to be at least a decade away, isn't it? Surely after the end of Episode 9, I feel like it needs that sizable gap to generate the excitement of those characters.
I feel it does, but I also feel that there should be three years between episodes, and that's not the case. That is absolutely not the case. So things are changing. Whether they go more than two Star Wars films a year is going to be one to keep an eye on.
Because, Marvel have got to the point where they can churn this stuff out. We've got three this year. It's not inconceivable that Star Wars could do something similar, though it does require them broadening the canvas significantly.
Yeah, which is one thing I think that Marvel and certainly DC are trying so that every film is different. And the X-Men movies are doing that pretty well at the moment. I really enjoyed the Deadpool 2 trailer that came out this week. I thought it was a lot of fun. And I'm really looking forward to that film. If we get three Star Wars films a year and they all have the same palette and they all play in the same sandpit, then that's going to be tricky. But Black Panther is as different from Avengers Infinity War as you can get, I'm guessing. I haven't seen Infinity War yet. And then we know that Ant-Man and the Wasp is not going to be as large or planet smashy. So
Thor Ragnarok was in a different planet, literally. And,
well, it was, as you know, it was Marvel's first comedy, right, James? Yes.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was.
That's exactly what it was.
A comedy, not a horror.
So we'll keep an eye on that one.
Here's an interesting one.
Okay.
So Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed on to an Amazon limited series. So not a TV show as such, but a limited event series on Amazon called Outrider, which is a Western in which he plays a US Marshal. Now, interestingly, no one to my knowledge has reported this fact, but this is a project that has been knocking around for the better part of two decades. And yet no one seems to have picked up on this. Like Outrider was a project that he was considering as a movie before he went into politics. And the only reason I know this, when I did my big Schwarzenegger interview when we did the big Schwarzenegger issue of Empire, he talked about this film and he said that when he had gone back, when he was doing The Last Stand, that Outrider had resurfaced and he was trying to get it back off the ground as a movie. So clearly it's kind of metamorphosed from a movie to a limited series, which is quite interesting. He also ruined it for me by telling me the ending, which I want to share. Literally, he goes, yes, we are looking for Outrider and it's this and XX, beep, 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 happens at the end. Great, cheers. Thanks, Arnie. Brilliant. Won't be watching that then. It might have changed. But it sounds very good. It does sound very good. It's interesting. Him as the first Austrian US Marshal. in the Wild West.
Mm. Okay, that's that. Yeah, I'm on board for that. There's a Conan, a King Conan series as well.
Also going to Amazon, but not featuring Arnold.
Not with Arnold, which seems like a strange one, unless they want a younger King Conan.
Mm.
Should we talk more about some of the trailers that dropped around the Super Bowl?
Yeah, we've had so many this week.
Well, you mentioned Deadpool. Let's start with that one.
Yes. That didn't drop at the Super Bowl, but let's talk about it anyway.
But that dropped very unexpectedly yesterday, wasn't it?
Yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, which was pretty awesome. Really yesterday when we're recording this, 2 days ago when you're listening to it. Really, really unexpected. Loads of personality, loads of fun. Heavy on the cable guy, if you will.
Yeah, they've really dialed in on cable, but still delivering all the kind of Deadpool.
There is one shot. It's basically a small handful of frames in this where you see Deadpool in the back of a helicopter and you see him with Domino and you see him with someone behind him with a kind of looks like a skull jaw and you see him with Terry Crews next to him as insert name of character here. And I was desperately trying to work out who are these people we know. You know, I listened to Terry Crews. Do you look a bit like Bishop? No, you don't. Not really. Were those dreadlocks? No, it's hard to say. I couldn't work out who anyone was.
Yeah, according to the internet, that group is confirmed as X-Force.
See, you say that, but which X-Force? Are we saying the new X-Force, which it can't be that, because that's Wolverine, X-23, Deadpool, that lot. And it's like, old X-Force is like Feral, Shatterstar, you know, it's not them. So is it an X-Force that I just am unfamiliar with?
You have out-marveled me.
Sorry.
I do not know.
I have the number one X-Force somewhere in my loft, I think.
Awesome. I think I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the trailer. I thought it was fun, and it has that lovely breaking the fourth wall bit where Deadpool comes in the middle of the trailer and starts playing with the toys.
Because they haven't finished effects. Yes, it's nice.
And I love the payoff line as well, where Cable says to him, you know, something along the lines of, you're fucked, and Deadpool, Wade Wilson, just turns the camera and goes, well, that's just really lazy writing. You know, Ryan Reynolds absolutely owns that role.
He's hilarious. I cannot wait to see it.
I mean, his personal Twitter feed is pretty much indistinguishable from Deadpool's, right?
Yeah.
It's one and the same.
Yeah, it's one of those great marriages of character and actor. You cannot see the join. You can't see the join between Robert Downey Jr. and Tony Stark. You can't see the join between Ryan Reynolds and Deadpool. They're just absolutely, they become one. I'm very excited about this. There were other great trailers as well. I thought the Mission Impossible Fallout trailer looked fantastic.
That really won the
Super Bowl for me. That was the one that really stood out. It's so punchy, literally and figuratively, with Henry Cavill absolutely knocking the crap
that
out.
That bit where Jerry Maguire beat up Superman was mental.
Yeah, it's gonna be full on.
I mean, the last three Mission Impossible films really have all been like, I've gone into them with relatively like high, but they're not my most anticipated films of the summer. But this one really is, based on the last few.
And we can all agree that the franchise peaked with number three. But you know, it's good.
No, we can't. We cannot agree. That's a stupid opinion. It's your opinion. You're entitled to your right to be wrong. So that's okay.
It's a horror.
The trailer has Tom Cruise hanging off three separate things. Which I mean, you've got to have Tom Cruise hanging off a lot of stuff on.
Have you seen the featurette about the helicopter?
No.
The helicopter sequence. He fucking learned to fly a helicopter and flies the helicopter.
Puts it into a downward spiral as well.
Like, man, this is, you're putting stuntmen out of business. There've got to be union rules that don't allow this.
But it's also, you know, this, he's been injured on this movie.
Yeah.
Have you seen the slow-mo footage?
The shots in the trailer.
Yeah.
And this trailer seems to be about the number of ways in which they've tried to kill Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
You know, like you see him hitting on a bike, and I'm sure there's some sort of CG work involved there to blur the lines. Smashing into a car and flying off the bike. You know, he smacks into the building, he falls off things. And maybe setting up the idea as well that Ethan Hunt is more fallible than he has been in the most recent movies.
There was a Jurassic World trailer as well.
That was good. I enjoyed that one. Yeah. It's got looks like some decent scares in store.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. As I mentioned, massive Jurassic Park fan. That's my favourite film. I am ready for it to be scary again. I know we were saying
a horror.
It's sort of a horror film, but the Jurassic World really kind of it wasn't scary. It was more all out action, and I was quite worried with the first Jurassic World 2 trailer. With all the exploding volcano and dinosaur stampede and that kind of thing, that it seemed to be very, very action-heavy. But this trailer has a lot of really creepy stuff, and it seems like there's going to be lots of the second half of the film set in a big old creepy house. Because they confirmed that the first trailer with all the volcano stuff is all within the first 50-ish minutes of the film. Mm-hmm. So presumably then a lot of the really kind of, quite scary and dark and all that stuff, I think, is going to be
And we can very much look forward to the return of Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard as colossal gender stereotypes A and B. So that's nice.
Yeah, hopefully they've switched up that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking to see very, very quickly. There was a ton of stuff happened this week. We've already talked about most of it. Stephen Merchant has joined a girl in the Spider's Web. Or the girl in the Spider's Web.
David Leitch might be doing the Fast and Furious spin-off.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome, because that man knows his way around an action set piece.
So this is the Rock and the Statham one.
The Statham, Rock
Hobbs
and the Statham.
Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But, I mean,
I'm on board for that.
If you've seen John Wick, if you've seen Atomic Blonde, this man is, he knows his onions.
Yeah.
So.
And we're recording this before the Phenom trailer has hit, so we won't know what that's like, but we will end on one last trailer, and you just mentioned Dwayne Johnson. Skyscraper.
Yeah.
A.K.A. Die Hard in a bigger building.
It's Die Hard meets San Andreas, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
With the emphasis, I would say, more heavily on the San Andreas as part of that.
It's
equation.
One of these films where I don't imagine for a second it's great, but I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it looks fun.
Yeah.
It looks fun. The poster that they put out just before the trailer drop looked like a Fast and Furious 7 moment where it's the car flying between three different skyscrapers, except if the car was The Rock.
Yeah.
And I'm up for that.
I'm up for it as well. It looks absolutely appalling.
We pointed out that some of the CGI, not even of the skyscraper, is like terrible. There's that shot of him walking in through the foyer.
Uh-huh.
And they haven't CGI'd the foyer to look realistic.
It's a trailer, they'll finish it in time, it's all good. But it does, I'm with Jimbo in this, it looks terrible, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't make that jump. There's no way he makes
no
that jump.
Way.
There's
like
just
physics
none.
Does not allow. And frankly, even if he does, he bounces off the glass.
Yeah, there's a hole in the glass, as the poster shows. So he's jumping for a hole. He's not trying to jump through the glass. He's trying to aim for a hole.
Frankly, unless there's a tilt on the table, it's not happening.
I think so. A very funny Twitter thread about the Rock.
The trajectory is.
Yeah. He's dead.
Yeah, he's dead. Spoiler.
Rest in peace.
So Jordan Peele might be doing a sequel to Get Out. Mm-hmm. I think we can all agree will be called Get In.
Or someone else pointed maybe And Stay Out.
That would be meta.
It should be good.
I haven't heard that news.
He was talking to the Hollywood Reporter. I think it was at one of the Oscar lunches.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, I'm definitely doing it, but it was, I'm actually seriously considering this. He says that he thinks there's more story to tell, and obviously there are some threads hanging at the end. He's basically said that I am seriously considering it, but I won't do it unless I come up with something really good.
Which is always good advice.
Yes. I've come up with something shit, guys.
Yeah, let's do it.
We start filming in April. imagine if someone said that. I've got no ideas. I've run out of ideas, but they offer me a great big whacking sack of cash.
This is one of these awkward things, isn't it? Where on the one hand, I really enjoyed that film, and I'd love to see more from those characters who I hugely enjoyed. But on the other hand, it works so well as a kind of capsule horror movie that I just feel it would lessen it in some way.
Not everything needs a sequel.
Absolutely not.
And that is a horror film.
Yeah, it is.
It's a horror film.
And an action sci-fi platoon movie.
Yes. Yes, it is. All right, that is it for the movie news. We'll be discussing Cloverfield Paradox and everything that involved in the reviews section in just a second. But first off, this week's guests, as I said in the intro, a double whammy of British Oscar-winning goodness, Colin Firth and Rachel Weisz, never worked together, weirdly enough. I checked it out. I thought maybe they might have had like an episode of Inspector Morse or Casualty in their past, but no, they've been ships in the night until now, until this week's The Mercy, where Colin Firth plays Donald Crowhurst, who embarked on an ill-fated attempt to sail around the world in 1969. That is not a spoiler. You can look this up. And Rachel Weisz plays his wife, Claire Crowhurst, who stayed at home whilst he went off on this solo adventure and waited for him to come back. It's directed by James Marsh. We'll talk about it in the review section as well. I liked it a lot. I think these two are terrific in the movie, and they were terrific together as well. When I went to speak to him this week at a top London hotel, we spoke about a great many things, and then we got a little bit sillier towards the end as well, so enjoy that stuff. Here we are, Colin Firth and Rachel Weisz. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined by Rachel Weisz and Colin Firth, stars of The Mercy. How are you both?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Very well.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Not too bad, not too bad. So it's the morning after the night before. Last night you had your world premiere, and now here you are doing press. I imagine you'd rather have the day off. Are you okay?
Always.
You can be honest with me.
Well, the other answer is it's been very interesting to hear everyone's reactions, which is kind of what we've gotten to hear. And a couple of people have said to us that that they felt like it was a horror film. Which
yes.
hadn't, maybe it crossed your mind, but it hadn't crossed my mind as a kind of genre heading, that it was a sort of psychological, internal horror movie.
Absolutely.
No, you know, that the monsters are within rather than outside. But I thought that was really, interesting.
You know, when you dig into the story and some of his experiences as he reported them, some of that actually becomes explicit. And I don't want to reduce that to a banal point about it feeling like horror, but one of his recordings, and this hadn't really quite occurred to me until I heard it, is it's almost magical thinking, a fear of the supernatural. Mm-hmm. And I thought, of course, that's going to be a component after all that solitude and the kind of fears they're going to manifest that way.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't know anything about sailing or this kind of adventure. I sort of thought, well, you're going to be afraid of storms, and you're going to be afraid of things going wrong with your boat, and you're going to be, there are all sorts of threatening situations, but I didn't think that what's it like at night thinking, what's that coming through the companionway? What's that noise
yes.
under the boat?
Yes.
Why does the moon look weird tonight?
Yes.
And maybe superstitions building up, I don't know.
Which is, obviously with sailors, is huge.
Is it?
Yeah. Yes. It's interesting. We have superstitions in the acting profession, obviously, in the theatre.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not supposed to whistle in the theatre. You're not supposed to whistle backstage. And I think that came from sailors because they were the people who came in to do the rigging in the early days of the theatre. And
really?
So I think there's something in common. When you have a situation where your fate is not entirely in your hands.
Yeah.
And I think this, you know, not that I'm pretending to know, but you hear these stories from soldiers as well, that you become very superstitious because your life and death is in the hands of random things.
Mm.
And so you start to develop little kind of, you make deals with the unexplained to try to make your fate feel better.
Mm.
And so I think that probably unlocks... That contributes to it. Yeah.
Especially there's a line in the film at one point about how no one is lonelier than a man on the sea in a boat, and I feel that sometimes when you, I've never been in that situation, but I imagine Crowhurst was trying desperately to rationalize himself and to not lose sight of himself as the only person that in his immediate worldview, the only person for miles around, and I imagine then you start to think, oh, there must be things bigger than I.
Yes, you're in conversation with your imagination the whole time.
Yeah.
Because the only other living contact you have is on the other end of a radio, or fish and birds, basically. I mean, I'm sure, you know, his imaginary conversations are going on all the time. Mm. But I mean, I think the loneliness, in some ways, you were saying, was just as great for Claire. You know, being lonely amongst people is no less lonely.
Mm, and having to perform for the cameras that came to visit her and document her duties as the, you know, the loyal wife, which she was, that wasn't a performance, but the performance must have been that she didn't want cameras shoved in her face
yes.
and she was in a lot of distress and pain.
And also for her kids. The performance of, I'm terrified for my husband, I'm worried he's not going to come back, but I can't show that. I can't even remotely let that on.
Exactly. I've found that very moving, and the grace in which, in the documentary footage I've seen of her from the time when she was full of grace and dignity and very, very noble, because she must have been suffering so much underneath.
In terms of the research for this, Colin, I imagine did you read all of Donald's logs, all his diaries that he left behind on the boat?
Yeah, I it became an obsession. It's calling it an obsession sounds as if it was just some sort of, you know, fevered exercise in consuming everything. It's almost presumptuous to say it about a real person who I've never met, but it feels like a relationship. You know, you start to see a part of yourself that's like him, and then there's a real him, and you can hear his voice on his tapes, and you can read his words, and there's a great intimacy in that. You know, these are the words of a man alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he was they weren't true probably to what to everything he was really thinking, because they were performances in a way, because they were for the BBC.
Yes.
But nevertheless, you're hearing a man who's been alone for months and months and months speaking into a microphone to be heard. And, you know, I'm the one on the other end listening. And I kept having this temptation to join the conversation. And it does go a long way to putting you in someone else's position. Mm. You know, his personal writings, his less personal writings, his recordings. But he did write about his dilemmas. I mean, the thing you hear in the film, my chances are at best 50-50.
Yeah.
You know, I can't... Those are his words. And it's...
At which point did he say that?
He wrote it in his log. He was in the South Atlantic. It was around the time he was... I can't remember where he was geographically. Mm. Well, no, at that point he was... I think he had... He went his radio silence. I think he was... If I remember, anyone can look this up, so it doesn't really matter, but I think he was about 3 months in.
3 months in.
Wow.
It might have been less than that, but he was about 3 months in when he could have probably made it to the Cape of Good Hope. And it was fairly early on. Because I'm afraid if you'd asked me two years ago, I'd have had
more
timelines.
No, it was such a long time ago.
Because, you know, it was before he decided to go into radio silence. Mm-hmm. And it was clearly before he was out of contact and before there was any discrepancy between where he was and where people thought he was. Mm-hmm. Mm. And I think at that point he might have had, it was when, you know, before he might have had, he still had the option just to pull in.
Right.
But the problem he got himself into at that early stage was, you know, because I think he avoided ever explicitly lying about anything. Mm-hmm. Despite all his appearances and all this, you know, people thinking that there was a cheat and hoaxing and all, he was always trying to avoid. I think he loved the truth. And I think it tormented him that he had to depart from it. Mm-hmm. What he said about his speeds were explicitly false in the early stages. Mm-hmm. You can call that a small... You know, compared to pretending I went around the world, that's a small lie.
But then he did sail that fast on the...
Well, he eventually made that speed. He reported 127 nautical miles in a day, which would have been a record. And on his way back, where he was, I think, recording authentic speeds, he did that. He achieved that.
Wow.
But he was past caring. Because he was in such a terrible predicament by that time.
Wow.
He wasn't celebrating his speeds anymore. And he was trying to slow down.
Yes.
So, you know, in those early stages, I think, you know, he thought, OK, maybe I'll cheer them up back home. Maybe this will get the press agent off my back.
Yeah.
You know, but the press agent exaggerated even further his progress.
As press agents,
and then there were misunderstandings about where he was.
Yeah.
And suddenly he was in this position which he'd never intended, I don't think, which was he was suddenly about 3,000 miles from where he was supposed to be, which made giving up and pulling in even more difficult. Because, you know, how do you pull into a port when you're supposed to be somewhere else?
Yeah.
So I think he tried to fix one problem and created a bigger one, and it ended up becoming something of catastrophic proportions.
In terms of your research as well, Rachel, I mean, am I right in thinking you chose not to get in touch with her? You chose not to talk to her, or...?
I haven't met her.
You haven't met her,
I would very much like to meet her.
Okay. But that's obviously a conscious choice then on your part. Or was it a conscious choice on her part not to...?
I don't know. It wasn't a conscious choice on my part.
Okay.
I can't speak for her, but I don't know if she. I would love to meet her. I would love to talk to her and meet her, but I also would completely respect and understand if she would rather not be.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
So, but I would welcome meeting her.
Because I imagine when you're playing real life people who are still alive, and not just people who are still alive, in terms of Donald's logs and diaries, and in terms of Claire being alive, is there a sense as actors that of how far you wish to push your research and into the realms of intrusion, in a way? Do you want to talk to someone and you know, about what they actually experienced in this very tragic situation when you're listening to Donald's voice recordings and the private thoughts of a man? Is there sometimes you think, maybe I've gone a little bit too far, or should I pull back?
It's a good question. And yes, there are times when you would want to pull back, but these were Donald Kroeher's public thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So in a way, that doesn't apply to the recordings.
Yes.
Because these weren't confidences that he was leaving for his family. This was his BBC recordings.
Yes, yes.
So it didn't apply to that. I think it did apply, perhaps, even though he wrote it and left it on board the boat for everybody to read, what he was going through in his last days. Because that was when his tone changed. And he wrote a kind of philosophy where he... I mean, it's been characterized as a kind of manic raving, where he went from just recording his daily life to saying he was a cosmic being. Mm-hmm. And using bits of Einstein and, you know... in order to, I think, rationalize an alternative to his predicament.
Yes.
In a way, I find it there's a coherence in it.
Yes.
I think, there's this idea that his spirit could migrate and evolve into a new dimension, and that was ultimately the fate of the human race, and that somehow he was initiating that process for all of us.
Wow.
We were going to become disembodied. And to me, that's... how do you get off the boat otherwise? He couldn't go home. He couldn't stay on that boat forever. It's his route home had been closed to him. And I think it was this yearning to get off, be free, and to still be finding something that was positive and joyous. You definitely can feel that you are getting in very intimate with somebody's sort of private mental state.
Yeah.
But there he did want to share that. He was speaking to all of us when he wrote that. And it was there for, I think he wanted it to be read.
And Rachel, when you're approaching playing a real life person as well, do you not let that bother you in a way? Do you? Because I imagine you just want to forge the character as it's on the page, as it is in your mind, without having to worry about, am I nailing this person's mannerisms? And
personally, I'm not interested in trying to do an imitation, kind of a photocopy of the person. But if there is source material, and that there were plenty of interviews, Colin's saying that they're public performances of the self, but they, you know, that presentation can tell you a lot about someone. I mean, all of that's very useful, and you can internalize it and then imagine your own version of the character will come up. I am not her. I'm not an imitation artist, and you know, I'm just trying to tell her story. But it's fuel. It's all. It was helpful.
Yes,
it was constructive, and
Is it, you know, I'd echo what you said about the, you know, because I'm not especially interested in the mimicry side of things either. And I think it's only really a pressure when you're playing someone that is so recognisable.
Yeah, iconic in some way.
Yeah.
Mm.
Otherwise, I think take advantage of the freedom to use as much of yourself as possible.
Mm. I was once offered Elizabeth Taylor. I got too scared.
Really?
Just because she's so famous, you know, and, you know, so everyone knows exactly what she seemed like, right?
Yes.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
So filmed.
Was that an immediate no, or did you talk with it?
No, I really wanted to, but I didn't dare. It was too scary.
You'd have made it marvellous.
Well, thank you. That's why I was just waiting for that.
Oh, man, that's a shame. But there's a really interesting thread throughout the movie, at the very beginning of the movie, and that Donald knew that he was ill-prepared. He knew that he was sailing into disaster deep down inside, and even in the movie he tries to pull out on the night before. And I've been in a situation where I'm hopelessly underprepared for things. Most interviews, as you'll have noticed in the last 10 minutes or so. And
hardly.
Oh, come on now. I just wondered if you've been in that situation as actors. Are there moments when you just haven't been prepared the night before a film, the night before a play, and you just know, oh, God, how am I going to get through this? You can tell me I'm a doctor.
Yeah, for me, yes. Yes. Often feels not well prepared enough.
Well, I think all a good story. No, I don't. But I mean, it's. I think it's almost every day I have a moment like that.
Yeah, it's true.
And obviously, the actors have the anxiety dream. Have you had the anxiety dream? I'm on stage and I suddenly don't know.
I'm playing Hamlet and I haven't learned the lines. Yeah. Always that. It's always Hamlet. And I did it for O level, so I get to say, oh God, I can remember like the first two lines of every soliloquy and nothing else. I have that as a recurring dream.
I do too, and it's Hamlet with me as well.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh my God,
it is. It's horrifying. Actually, I do remember I was at the National Youth Theatre, and I think I must have been about 18, 17 or 18, and we were doing Midsummer Night's Dream, and I was the only understudy, I think, or one of two, and I was understudying about four different people. And I'd learnt them all. This was about the time when I think we'd been up running for two nights. And I'd learnt them all except one of the characters. I'd still only learned half of that one. I just hadn't caught up yet.
Yeah.
And I'd learned Demetrius, Lysander, Oberon, and someone else. And the actor didn't show up. Of the guy I'd only learned half of.
Was it Puck?
No, it was one of the lovers. It was Demetrius or Lysander. But because the guy hadn't shown up earlier in rehearsals, and I'd come on with my lines learned, and everyone went, wow, he knows it. And I'd been watching the guy, and I'd gone through the block. So the director... The actor did show up at the very last minute, but he said, you know what, Colin? You're good enough. You go on. Which could have been Star is Born.
Oh, my God.
But because that was the one I only knew half of, that was a moment a bit like that. I've let everybody think that I've got this. And I thought, I could do the first half, and then I'll have to go on with it. You know, and it was never again would I allow myself to be that unprepared.
Oh, my God.
And it ended up okay, but I've had first nights where I have had an inner meltdown completely, where I've been convinced I cannot go on. I am not ready at all. I haven't had enough rehearsal. I don't know my lines well enough. I've just got to go on anyway. There's a terrifying little light backstage. You know, traffic lights. It's red, standby. You know, yellow means you're about to go. Green means walk, you're on. And that just means, ready or not, you go. It sometimes... It's not... No one's interested in whether you're ready.
Just do it.
You're on anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Rachel, have you ever been an understudy? Have you ever had that experience?
Not that experience, but I've had the experience of watching the light turn from red to amber to green and feeling absolutely
and the lines.
Not ready.
The backstage calls. This is your 5-minute call.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It's proper... It's horror. It's proper terror, isn't
it? It's terror.
Yeah. I think
it is as frightened as I'm capable of. I mean,
me too.
I'm not an actor. I've had the dream as well. I've had the dream of being on stage, suddenly thrust into a stage to doing a play for whatever reason. I have no idea why, and I don't know the lines. And I'm walking on with the text in my hand, just read it out. Mm. So it happens to us all. It's fine.
Sometimes in the dream, then I start to occasionally, mostly it's just I dry and I can't say anything. But there have been a couple of times where I've slightly enjoyed the dream where I've made Shakespeare up.
Oh.
Yeah. I sort of made it up and it sort of sounded, forsooth, my lord, my liege, your lunch, you know, whatever.
Do you dream an iambic pentameter? Is that?
Well, normally no, but there are a couple of times when I've made it up. Yeah, it's obviously.
I think you have more self love than I do. Possibly I do.
And in your dreams, have you ever played Elizabeth Taylor?
No.
I have.
And you'd be a spectacular Elizabeth Taylor, sir. Fantastic. Rachel, Colin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so that was Colin Firth and Rachel Fice. And that's kick off the reviews section with a very short review of Black Panther. And the reason why we're doing this now is because we're going to be reviewing it properly next week at our live show, which is being recorded on Valentine's Day, the evening of February 14th at King's Place, our 300th episode. And we're going to save our big review of Black Panther, which opens on the 13th. We're going to save that for Len. By the way, there are some tickets still available. We confirmed our guests this week. I still don't think I can announce them on Twitter, but believe me, if you come along on Valentine's Day, you will find cracking guests awaiting you. Plus, spot prizes. We need to sort those out.
Yes.
Spot prizes.
Please bring roses and chocolates and cards.
Yes. But for me, the emphasis heavily on chocolates, yes. So we're going to talk about Black Panther in depth next week. And obviously, there is a spoiler special as well. It is going to be coming your way on February 20th, I think. I just spoke to Ryan Coogler this morning and had a lot of fun doing it. And that was really, really interesting. So check that one out. But first, let's talk about Black Panther briefly. So Jimbo.
Briefly. Well, I liked it a lot. We gave this film 4 stars, a rating which I wholeheartedly endorse. I thought it was great. It's in following...
Ryan Coogler's now got he's got an alert on his phone going, thank God, James Dyer has wholeheartedly endorsed four stars.
It's true. I'm James Dyer and I've approved this message. really, really like this. I think following on, as it does, from Marvel's first comedy, it's a nice capsule movie. It's a very nice change of pace from the sort of global destruction that we see a lot, or intergalactic destruction in some cases. You know, takes very much, it's focused on Wakanda. It's that sort of like world-building ecosystem in this kind of protectorate African nation. And it's a really interesting exploration of that character. I'm not sure what I was expecting from this film, but loved the character, didn't love the action as much.
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
Not because it's bad, but it's more modest,
generic.
Less ambitious, slightly more generic, yeah. And a little more CG-heavy than I think I would have ideally liked. Ultimately, when you have two guys fighting in CG costumes, you end up with two CG characters wailing on each other. And there's something about that visual that lacks the punch of having, you know, real people in broad and I'd take a David Leitch action sequence, you know, it's worlds apart from that.
Yeah.
That said, watching, and sorry to DC's fans for having to say this, but watching two characters in this film, CG characters wailing on each other, is a world apart from watching two DC characters wailing on each other.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Just in that, no.
Can open, worms everywhere. You did not. No, that's. Why have you done this?
I'm sorry.
The door.
They are.
If they release the Snyder Cut banner.
Yeah.
No.
Throwing each other through buildings repeatedly until we fall down.
Yeah. All right. But so it looks amazing.
Yeah, it does.
And it's very hard to overemphasize the cultural significance of this movie. I mean, this movie means so much to so many people. And T'Challa is an African character.
He is, yeah.
And the interesting thing about this movie is that it is almost entirely set in Africa, albeit a fictional country, Wakanda. It is almost entirely populated by African characters.
Yep.
But that's extraordinary. And it is suffused. It is just absolutely suffused with African influences, design influences, music influences, cultural influences, which makes it feel, I think, unlike anything we've seen in the MCU.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is interesting because beyond that, it's actually a fairly standard Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. It reminded me a lot of the template of Ant-Man and Doctor Strange and Iron Man. It feels very much like an origin story in that way. But it looks and feels completely different beyond that.
Also, just without going into too much more detail, because we are going to cover this next week, Michael B. Jordan, he is absolutely magnetic as Killmonger. I thought incredibly charismatic actor.
The cast are all smashing. I think that Danai Gurira, who plays Michonne in The Walking Dead, is one of the standouts of this movie for
me. She's the MVP in many ways.
In many ways, as Okoye, who's one of the Dora Milaje, who the sort of all-female fighting force. You got a glimpse of them in Civil War, who accompanied T'Challa on his travels, and can in many ways kick as much ass as the Black Panther can. I love Letitia Wright as Shuri, his sister, who's very, very smart and very, very sarky. Black Panther's Q in many, many ways, and we talk about that in the spoiler special. And so, you know, it's got a lot going for it. I do agree that 4 stars is absolutely right. I think this is one that's going to grow with repeated viewings. So 4 stars for the Black Panther. And if you thought that wasn't a long review, we went a little bit longer than anticipated. Sorry about that. But we'll be weighing in next week at the live podcast with Helen and Terry in attendance as well. So that's going to be a lot of fun. We don't have a lot of time left to talk about the Cloverfield Paradox.
Yes, which dropped on Sunday night, wasn't it? Just came out of nowhere, appeared.
Yeah. Now, this is the big one. We were talking about, could a movie ever just appear without marketing? And then the Cloverfield Paradox, they must be listening to the podcast. That's got to be it. Did so. So the story of the film, very, very quickly, It was owned by Paramount. It was funded and owned by Paramount. Paramount sold it a couple of weeks ago to Netflix. And the reason for that seems to be that they didn't think it would make a lot of money at the box office. It might have got a critical kicking, which it did, which it has. And so to maybe offset either a small profit, they went for a bigger profit. And there's reports this week that they sold it for $50 million. Okay, so they did that. And that means it's not going to get a cinematic release. It gets released instead on Netflix. We knew it was going to be on Netflix, but we didn't know when. We thought it was going to be April. And then at the Super Bowl, they dropped the trailer going, this is available after the game.
And the cast didn't know it was going to drop. And they didn't know the title either, did
they? That's correct, yeah. Yeah, I spoke to David Oyelowo last night and Roger Davis, who plays Michael in the film. And yeah, they said they had no idea. And in fact, they didn't really know that when they were making it that it was a Cloverfield movie. So these things change, don't they? They change. But let's talk about the movie itself. So it is set in a space station.
It is.
And it features a group of astronauts, a group of international astronauts, including an Irish astronaut played by Chris O'Dowd. Well done. We knew we'd get someone up in the sky eventually. Come on, lads, don't be afraid of it. And so he plays an Irish astronaut, and it stars Gugu Mbatha-Raw, David Oyelowo, who else is in it? Daniel Brühl, Sang Sii. Really, really good cast. And they're trying to save the planet, which is depleting its energy resources. And to do so, they trigger a big old particle accelerator, and then things go wrong from there.
Indeed.
And how it becomes a Cloverfield film, we can't discuss. But we are going to do a spoiler special in this film.
Yeah.
I'll talk about that in a second. But the film itself, what do you think?
It's very average, isn't it? It goes where so many similar films have gone better before. You know, it's not as good as Life. It's not as good as Event Horizon. It's not as good as Armageddon. You know, it's guys on a space station. There's a little bit of tension. There's a little bit of horror. But it's very uneven. It's not really very scary. It's not really very exciting. Chris O'Dowd is pretty funny, but he's not given a... he's inherently funny, but the material he has isn't spectacular either. And I don't think you're ever that invested in what's going on. You're not all that interested in seeing how it plays out, because the fundamental conceit, I think, is fairly obvious from the get-go. Not a lot of surprises. Again, it feels a lot like a kind of a slightly middle-of-the-road science fiction film, albeit one with a fantastic cast, which has been shoehorned into the Cloverfield template at the 11th hour. Which seems to be the trend here.
Ben?
I've kind of changed my mind on this. So I watched it on Monday night when I got home from work, and I was really disappointed. I loved 10 Cloverfield Lane, and that was such a surprise, and it was so sharp and so tight, and that's not what I got from the Cloverfield Paradox. But I saw it again last night at a screening. There was like a screening, so I could see it in a pretty much cinema surrounding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a combination of getting the chance to see it on a big screen and seeing it for the second time around, I actually had quite a lot of fun with it. It is not a great film, and it's not tight, and it's not as sharp. The tension in 10 Cloverfield Lane is so sharp, and it feels like it started out as a really, really strong script. The script here is the problem. But I think it's a shame that people won't get a chance to see this on the big screen, because I think visually it's really strong. I think like the design of the spaceship, and so it reminded me in some ways of JJ's Star Trek. The use of color, mm-hmm. the amount of kind of that combination of really smooth, clean surfaces, but also it's not the really gritty industrial alien thing. It looks really good on the big screen, and as well the score I think adds a lot to it.
Okay.
And it makes it feel really pacey, and it was more engaging seeing it on a big screen than it was.
It's Bear McCreary again, isn't it?
Bear McCreary.
He did a fantastic job with Cloverfield Lane, actually. I love that score.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like a game changer for me in many ways, so I'd be really intrigued to see whether this happens again, and will it happen again? We know, for example, that the fourth Cloverfield movie, Paramount still own the rights to the franchise, and the future of the franchise will be released on the big screen. But that's what it's telling us right now. But you never know how that might turn out. This is the World War II zombie thing
we were
talking about last week, Overlord, if that's indeed its name. It feels like the event of the movie itself and its release is perhaps more important than the movie itself.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll get into that. We'll get into the whole thing about watching it on the big screen versus watching it on the small screen, and what it must be like, I imagine, for a director who makes something with a big screen and then suddenly having that taken away from you. But at the same time, you know that probably more people are going to watch it on Netflix than would have ever watched in the cinema. There must be a strange pull there. There must be a strange dilemma for directors. This isn't like a Duncan Jones with Mute or Gareth Evans with Apostle. It's not like that at all. This is a different situation. But the movie itself, you know, it's fine. It's one of those movies that reminds you that there are better movies out there.
It's fun.
It's a bit of fun. in places. Let's not get carried away.
It's the sort of thing you can actually understand. If you had paid to go and see it at the cinema, you would probably not be as happy as you are if you're just slouched at home on your sofa in your boxer shorts and you just fancy a nice flick on your living room couch.
That is actually a very valid point. I could not recommend going to the cinema to see this. I could absolutely recommend spending an hour and a half watching it on Netflix.
So there you go. Or indeed an hour and 45 minutes. Unless you just want to stop 15 minutes before the end.
Don't watch the last 15 minutes, is what I'm saying. Although that said, this is a film which has two parallel narratives, one of which is the bulk of it, and the other which is one of the most underwritten things I've ever encountered. And whenever you switch back to like the B plot, you're like, what are you doing? Just move on. It seems to exist solely to push product placement for M&Ms. But anyway.
I did want some M&Ms afterwards, so it worked.
So did I.
I always want M&Ms. Crispy are the best. Okay, so two stars. We gave two stars then to The Cloverfield Paradox. And then we're going to very, very quickly talk about The Mercy, or more accurately, I'm going to talk about The Mercy because these two MFers haven't seen it. I'm trying to keep a PG-13.
In keeping with the film, I could just pretend that I've seen it.
Where we go round and round in circles.
Oh, my word. Oh, my word. You guys
we've
have
gone
done
meta.
You've done some reading. So this is directed by James Marsh. It is the story of Donald Crowhurst, who in 1969, he was an ordinary guy. He was a bit of an entrepreneur, a bit of an inventor, a bit of a hobbyist of a sailor. And he decided to enter a round-the-world solo sailing competition called the Golden Globe. The first prize was £5,000, which is a lot now, and it was even more back then. And he builds a trimaran to do this, gets some sponsorship, puts his family's future, their house, their business, everything on the line to try and do this, embarks upon the cruise, knows he is overwhelmingly underprepared, knows that he's probably sailing into disaster because he's British and that's what we do. We run headlong, head first off a cliff, knowing that bad things wait for us down below.
Is this a metaphor for Ben's first podcast appearance?
It's a metaphor for many things. Bexit. It's a metaphor for that. And he gets on the boat anyway. And then in the course of doing that, he realised very, very quickly that he was completely and hopelessly out of his depth and that his chances of survival were 50-50, as you've heard in the interview with Colin Firth. And so he decides to fabricate his position along the route and then rejoin the race. His plan was to rejoin the race and then just come in last. And let's just say things go horribly wrong and he himself went insane, as evidenced in his logbooks and diaries and voice recordings that he left behind as well. And so meanwhile, we're following Colin Firth on the open sea, and Rachel Fice at home, waiting for her husband to come back, trying to put on a brave face for the media, for the people of the country, and of course for her family. And it's a really interesting, heart-wrenching drama at times. Fascinating stuff. So we gave it 4 stars, and I would absolutely agree with that 100%. So 4 stars then for The Mercy. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast and Ben's debut on the podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by... Can't say, because it's a live really podcast.
Live and unleashed, uncensored, unrated. It's going to be
a lot of fun.
It's going to be scandalous.
And
there will be swearing.
Yeah, we should go a little bit blue for the on the live podcast. But yeah, what can you do? So if you want to come along and see that, there's still a couple of tickets left. So buy them now. kingsplace.co.uk. That's going to be a lot of fun. And see you then, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. It's been wicked to be on here.
Oh,
I'm gonna drill that into you.
Okay.
In the next few weeks.
That's good. And of course, it's goodbye for James as well.
Yeah, sweet in it or something.
Yeah, and check out our Cloverfield Paradox spoiler special with J.J. Abrams and the director Julius Onah, which is going to be up on Monday or Tuesday when I get around to it. I am off to once again try and storm the stage and play King George III in Hamilton. One of these days, they won't be able to stop me. Thanks a lot. Bye.